This is an ABC podcast.
Mālo tau mai bombongini, whakalovelei atu, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. As always, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Stories today, wreckage from World War II. It's been scattered across the Pacific, but who is responsible for the cleanup? We have Pacific climate activists releasing a doco to mark the start of their activism in Canberra, and we hear more about why Vanuatu is the happiest place on the earth. More on these stories shortly. And when you want to find a little bit more about these stories, simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine and feel free to share across your social media platforms. Remember, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and you're tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Bombs and wreckage from the Second World War are scattered all over the Pacific. But what progress is being made to clean it all up? According to some experts, not nearly enough, particularly from one of its major participants, the US. Now there's fresh calls for the US to invest more into cleanup efforts, as Carl Evans reports.
In PNG, the Kokoda Trail is the most famous track from the Second World War. However, there's another, the Black Cat Track near Leh, where the fighting was just as fierce, and many death traps still lurk.
Black Cat Track had seen a lot of nasty battles at that time. Even walking through the track itself, you'd see the remnants of the battle positions, and you'd see digging pits, fighting pits.
Captain Derek Levy is a field engineer in the PNG Defence Force. He specialises in the disposal of unexploded ordnance, or UXO, around Leh on the country's north coast. What he found on the Black Cat Track in 2019 haunts him to this day.
When we started walking, the locals started showing us where the dumps were. So the first dump that we came across was a US military cache. So they used that cache to supply all their call signs along the Salamoa area. Yeah, and then along the track, there's heaps of UXOs. We came across the other one, there's like a dump of like mortar rounds, like I think 60 mil mortar rounds, up to the size of a knee height.
Captain Levy plotted the location of the ammo dumps and filed a report to the provincial government. From there, Derek says a request was sent to the US Embassy to try and kickstart a clearance of UXOs in the area. They still haven't heard back.
That was back in 2019. I'd like to see them do more. I'd like to see them do more in terms of clearance, and also the second and third order effect of that clearance would allow the locals to carry on with their normal lives. The locals want to carry on their normal lives in going and doing their subsistence farming and gardening and stuff. But now they're restricted because they can't go out. I think US need to do a lot. Same goes for the Australian brothers and the Japanese government as well.
His comments echo those of PNG Prime Minister James Marape, who recently called on the US to clean up the wreckage of war in his country. But the problem is complex. Kim Acosta is a consultant for Safe Ground, an Australian not-for-profit organisation that aims to reduce the impacts of explosive remnants of war. She said there's hundreds of thousands of rounds of unexploded rounds still lurking in PNG, but not nearly enough surveying is being done.
It's very similar to everywhere across the Pacific. There's just a lack of resources, which means that they can't spend the time, the money, the personnel scaling it in a way that will sort of comprehensively address the problem.
Like Derek, she says the US is not doing enough.
They do have a couple of small projects. They fund an organisation called the Halo Trust, which is a British NGO, and they're funding survey in the Solomon Islands at the moment. And I think they're also funding a small project in Palau as well, which is a good start. But in the grand scheme of, you know, the level of contamination in the Pacific, it really is only just scratching the surface.
For the US, much of its resources goes towards finding lost servicemen, such as President Joe Biden's uncle, Ambrose Finnegan, whose plane was shot down over PNG. However, Kim says much of this work is carried out by private contractors, relic hunters, many of whom don't report ordnance or UXOs when they find them.
There is a lack of communication, I guess, between different parties that are working in this space, and a lack of coordination as well. I think there's quite a lot of knowledge out there, but it is a challenge to collect that knowledge firstly and bringing it together in a way that's meaningful. And by that I mean, you know, if you are out looking for the bodies of servicemen and you find items, who do you report it to? You know, you need to pick up the phone and call someone, but who'll answer that phone? If they do answer the phone, where are they recording the information about what's being found? How are they responding to that? Do they have the capacity to go out and address it? Quite often there's not the coordination structures in place at national level to be able to respond to this in a way that is sort of quick and efficient and that makes communities safer.
One of the many contractors who carries out these types of missions is not-for-profit firm SEALARC Exploration. They contract out to the US Department of Defence. Director Matt Ray says the competitive nature of the industry might dissuade some firms from reporting what they find, not realising they could be putting people at risk.
Probably not everyone's on that side is going to give away what they know. I don't know, that sounds a bit harsh, but a lot of these companies are actually out there to make money. The way we work is, you know, we're a not-for-profit. We're doing it for the greater good. Globally, there's always interest in World War II planes, and I don't know, in the Solomon Islands, especially northwest, there's been problems in the past with planes, especially from land, being removed.
Kim says even the good work, such as what's done by Australian bomb disposal squads as part of Operation Render Safe in places like the Solomon Islands and Bougainville, doesn't get documented in a public database, so it's hard to get an idea of what areas have been cleared and are safe. She says she wants to see that changed. Back in Leh, Captain Levy says he'd like to see operations like Render Safe extended to PNG.
Logistically, Leh would be simple to conduct the task because you have all the resources here. You have hospitals there in case of cash evac. You have airports or landing zones, and there's logistically it would be easy to conduct it all from Leh. And also you have us here, the engineer battalion here in Leh. For me, it would be an opportunity for me to cross-train with our EOD guys and with our ADF.
And that was Captain Derek Levy, a field engineer in the PNG Defence Force, ending that report by Carl Evans. And we have contacted the US Defence on the matter, but are still waiting to hear back. Now, where could the happiest place in the world be? Look no further than Vanuatu, who has topped the latest Happy Planet Index for balancing good lives with a low ecological footprint. Now, the ranking does not factor emotional happiness into its calculation, but it combines data on well-being, carbon footprints and life expectancy, and ranks countries on these three data sets worldwide accordingly. Vanuatu's Culture Centre Director Richard Shing says there are still areas of improvement, but they are happy about current results. Mr. Shing spoke to Leah Loanbu about Vanuatu's participation in the Happy Planet Index.
We're very, very excited being nominated first on this list again after so many years. And I think it's an appreciation of our cultural heritage, our custom and culture. We have been, of course, doing a lot of work investing in the protection, preservation and promotion of our cultural heritage for so many years. So such announcements can really make us very happy in that our work is being recognized in the sustainability and well-being of people's livelihoods.
Definitely. So what do you attribute the top list score to? Is it to culture, the environmental leadership of Vanuatu?
Yes, thank you very much. There are four main criteria. First and foremost, access to traditional land. All indigenous Vanuatu citizens are born with access to land and resources. Secondly, it was based on the traditional knowledge, cultures and practices around how people use the environment sustainably in a way that the resources and the land are available in similar conditions for our future generation to come. Thirdly, our TP system is very vital and ensuring that the resources in the environment are utilized in a way that are not detrimental. Also, what's important in the criteria is the legislations and laws and acts and policies that the government has enacted since independence to ensure that the environment was adequately protected for the future generations.
So now the self-reported happiness in Vanuatu is about 7.1% out of 10, which is similar to Australia, but not quite as high as some Northern European countries, while life expectancy is about 70 years. But it is combined with a low environmental footprint. That's what makes the top score. So Vanuatu's leadership in the environmental realm really has made a difference here.
Yes, we believe that our traditional way of life has zero or negative carbon footprint, in that every individual, even though we cut down trees or we harvest crops, we replant and we ensure forests are managed, gardens take place of cleared areas. And so it's part of the cycle. In that sometimes you might pollute by lighting a fire to cook your meal, but also you plant, ensure that the oxygen is regenerated. People have overutilized, overused resources, but the majority in Vanuatu are still living in a cultural way, in a traditional way, that is in harmony with the environment around them.
So the index found that top 10% of earners globally are responsible for nearly half of all emissions, but have almost no gain in well-being and health over low emitters. Does that come as a surprise?
Not really. In Vanuatu, there's very little pollution per se, as in comparison to other countries per capita. Majority of people live in the rural areas, and they have a very traditional lifestyle, like I said, zero or negative carbon footprint, and I believe are satisfied with what they have around them. So there is a correlation, I believe, between low emitters and better well-being, if I may say something like that.
Thank you, Director. So in terms of policy makers in Vanuatu and the government, what advice would you give to them for Vanuatu to be and continue to be at that top list or to improve?
Firstly, I think the government should be proud that we have achieved, Vanuatu has achieved such ranking, or first ranking in any event. We still have a lot of work to do to ensure that like you said, the 7-point-something happy index aspect of it. There are still a lot of other issues that need to be worked on to ensure that people's lives improve. But I believe we are in a good position to ensure that we can make things better for the future to come.
Thank you again, Director. Just lastly, what advice would you have for other countries in the Pacific and elsewhere to achieve what Vanuatu has?
So basically, at the moment, I don't believe any Pacific Island country is on the Happy Planet Index, specifically because no kind of data is available. We are encouraging other countries in Melanesia and in the Pacific to look at this as a way forward and try to utilize the resources we have. We, Vanuatu, I'm sure the Wellbeing Indicators Project in Vanuatu will be glad to assist other countries run similar surveys.
And that's the director of Vanuatu Cultural Centre, Richard Shing, speaking to our ABC reporter, Leah Lowenbu. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl. We head to New Zealand, where in recent years, the Māori concept of tikanga has been adopted into the common law. It will be used in an upcoming court case on climate change brought by a Māori elder against the country's corporate polluters. Justice Joe Williams, the first Māori member of New Zealand's highest court, its Supreme Court, spoke to Damien Carrick about the concept.
Tikanga is a Māori word for custom, I suppose. Its base word is tika, which means correct or true, and the NGA on the end of it, to make it tikanga, basically means the correct way of doing things or correct process or just process. And it's about as close in the Māori language as you can get to the idea of law, although it's a bit more than law because it also includes some things that are a good idea, proper behaviour, courteous behaviour, but we wouldn't generally think of them as law. So think of tikanga as a bigger idea than law, but law is inside it as a subset.
The case that established tikanga as part of the common law, that was the case of James Takamore back in 2012. And I believe you were actually involved with it, so just acknowledging that and what you can and can't say. But can you tell us about who he was and how tikanga was argued in that case and why the decision's so important?
The Takamore case was a case about where James Takamore should be buried. And according to tikanga, he should be buried at home in his tribal village in the usual fashion. He no longer lived there. He lived in Christchurch in the South Island, not in the North Island where his people are from. He had a Pākehā spouse and three children.
So a European New Zealander spouse.
Yes, yeah. a European New Zealander spouse. Apparently they had little connection with their home marae or their home village. Nonetheless, the family from the village came down to Christchurch, took the body, and James Takamore was buried at Kutarere, where he was from.
Next to his father.
Next to his father, that's right. The children and the spouse took the matter to court, and orders were made at both the High Court and Court of Appeal level that the body should be exhumed and returned to Christchurch in accordance with the wishes of the spouse, who was also the executor of the estate. In the Supreme Court, the judges agreed with that outcome, but in so agreeing, they also agreed that as a matter of common law principle, tikanga can inform the scope of the discretions available to an executor of an estate. Now, people often say that's the first time tikanga was kind of infused in that way. That's actually not correct. There are a number of cases in the 19th century, the earlier days of colonisation, where tikanga was much more powerfully present in the life of the colony, in which the courts applied tikanga. They're just forgotten about because, of course, the indigenous dimension in the country faded over time as, you know, the settler population swamped the indigenous population and so forth. So in a sense, Takamore and Alice represent something of a turn back to those basic ideas, rendered necessary because, of course, the indigenous dimension in the country now is brighter than it has been for 100 and however many years, not the same as it was in 1840 or 50, but more than it has been since then.
The demographics are shifting.
The demographics are shifting. The treaty settlement process has meant the tribes are rebuilding, restoring their economic bases, being present in both the economics and the politics of the country, and a signal, really, that the treaty settlement process in Aotearoa is achieving at least some of its aims. That raising of the profile, not just demographically, but politically and economically, puts tikanga back into the discussion.
And I believe you were involved in the mediation between the nuclear family and the ancestral family, and we can't talk about that, but there was a resolution.
Well, I can say that despite orders that James Takamore be exhumed, there was a settlement between the wider whānau, as we call it, and the immediate family of James Takamore, in which James Takamore stayed in Kutarere. And this was, it seemed to me, an outcome that met the needs of all parties.
There are, of course, critics of this idea of tikanga and it being incorporated into the common law. I've read about a former MP with a Libertarian ACT Party, Stephen Franks, he's a lawyer, has said that the greater use of tikanga is a dangerous trend that undermines democracy and the rule of law. And he said, quote, "What we are doing is licensing our judges to decide cases on how they feel and not according to the law. Because it is unwritten, tikanga is easily invented to suit and you can't subject it to normal rationality constraints." How do you respond to those sorts of criticisms of tikanga?
The simple response to that is that is a comment by someone who has no idea about tikanga, because if they did, they wouldn't be saying those things. Tikanga is as old as the common law, and it is, for its own purposes, just as clear and just as disciplined. And as cases come to be litigated that address it, because legislation requires it, or because the common law requires it, lawyers will come to realise that.
And that is Judge Joe Williams of the New Zealand Supreme Court speaking to The Law Report's Damien Carrick. Stay tuned because we've got your news wrap up next with producer Evan Wasuka here on Pacific Beat.
Are you wanting to break your betel nut addiction, zumba your way to a fitter you, or get on top of that excruciating case of gout? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has you covered. Pacific Pulse seeks out experts, movers and shakers, and aunties and uncles from across our region to bust open our health issues, challenge taboos, and separate fact from fiction. Join host Melissa Macon on Pacific Pulse Wednesday at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, it is that time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines with our news wrap brought to us by producer Evan Wasuka. Well, it's been a while, Evan, but thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, no, enjoying the early morning crispy Melbourne air to be here.
Absolutely, appreciate your time this morning. Hey, look, we start in Papua New Guinea where a group of foreign nationals have been caught attempting to cross illegally into Australia. How's this?
Yeah, so this story is from our PNG correspondent, Marion Farr, and it's about five men who are now in custody after they were caught crossing illegally into Australia on a small dinghy in far north Queensland. Now, the men are reportedly from Senegal in Africa, and they're in custody right now on Saibai Island in the Torres Strait. That's about 4 km from Papua New Guinea's mainland. So PNG Police Commissioner David Manning says the group traveled to Papua New Guinea via Indonesia, and then they used fake travel documents before they attempted to cross into North Queensland. Two Papua New Guinea nationals are being questioned over their involvement in this trafficking of the five men to Australia. Mm. It's understood that the men are in the custody of the Australian Border Force. It's a new situation. We haven't seen something like this, and it's something that the ABC is keeping a close eye on, out of Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, we also know that Australia's foreign minister is heading to the Pacific for a 24-hour visit.
That's right. So Australia's foreign minister, Penny Wong, and her coalition counterpart, Simon Birmingham, they're making a bipartisan trip to the Pacific. So this is like the opposite sides of parliament. So they're heading off to Tuvalu, which, if you remember last year, they signed that landmark migration and security pact with Australia, the Falepile Union. So the two Australian officials are heading there. As we know, Tuvalu is facing issues with climate change. It's one of those things where Australia is helping out, and this Falepile Union is part of that agreement, which will provide permanent residency to Tuvalu citizens. So Senator Wong and Senator Birmingham say this trip will be used to stress Australia's enduring commitment to the Pacific. So we'll find out more once they land and the talks begin.
Absolutely. Speaking of trips, though, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka is on a tour of the United Kingdom with a royal visit on the cards.
Yeah, so Sitiveni Rambuka is over at the United Kingdom, which is home to a sizable amount of Fiji's diaspora population. We know a lot of Fijians serve in the British Army and have gone on to make their homes in the UK. The Fiji Broadcasting Corporation is reporting that in a community meeting, Rambuka announced that he'll be meeting King Charles III as part of his visit to the UK. He also mentioned that during the talk with the community that a planned trip to the Pacific by King Charles later this year might not happen. Some interesting news over there from the UK. And during that visit, Rambuka spoke about the long ties between the United Kingdom and Fiji, dating back to the colonial period, and how it's part of there's a common link between the two countries.
Absolutely. Look, Evan, thank you so much for bringing our headlines this morning with our news wrap. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Aggie.
thanks for tuning in to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBol. Now, this is a story of friendship and the power of music to overcome language barriers and form new cultural understanding. The journey of Palm visa workers in Warrnambool, Victoria, from the kill floor of the abattoir to the Port Fairy Folk Festival stage. Produced by ABC Southwest Victoria, feature reporter Emily Bislin.
In the regional city of Warrnambool in Western Victoria, a group of migrant workers from Timor-Leste went from the kill floor of the abattoir to the main stage of one of Australia's biggest music festivals. All thanks to Kalani singer-songwriter Billy Barker.
Billy Barker has recently returned to the Southwest. He's been working with a lot of local musicians. We'll hear some of that story shortly. Please welcome him, though, to the stage now with Livia Vincent joining as well.
On a boat, now at sea, if it gets rough, must be me.
Billy's a country carpenter who, back from a stint in the multicultural melting pot of Melbourne, was craving cross-cultural friendship and found it in the most surprising of places, Warrnambool's abattoir.
Because I'm a carpenter, I'm usually heading to work at about 6:30 in the morning, and I would drive through the industrial area in Warrnambool past the Midfields abattoirs and would see the groups of workers lining up to walk into the plant. I just remember thinking there'd have to be some incredible musicians amongst that bunch, like, you know, all these island nations that I knew were working there. Like, music's obviously such a big part of their culture.
Midfield Meat International processes over 2 million beasts a year, so they need a lot of workers. A large proportion of their employees are recruited through the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, which allows Australian companies to hire from the nine Pacific Islands and Timor-Leste when there isn't enough local labour.
Which is how I ended up reaching out to Midfields, the abattoir. So I just did up a pretty basic flyer saying that I was looking for anyone that was a musician. And those flyers went up, and then I think 3 months went by and I thought, oh, well, it was worth a try.
I see the flyer in our smoke room, and then I took one, and then it's Billy.
3 years into his four-year working visa, Jose da Costa was missing his wife and three children back in Timor-Leste.
We want to involve in the community here, because we stay here for a long time. So we don't want to just go to work.
Jose used to be a cameraman, but took up the opportunity to work in the abattoir in Warrnambool because it could change his family's life.
To come to Australia, we have to compete with other people, many people, the young people. They all fight to come to Australia. Yeah, we get more money if you compare to Istimo. We can build a house. We can send our kid to school. This is only one opportunity to change your life. Even hard job, we have to keep doing.
Jose took a flyer, organised his friends and messaged Billy.
And then I finally got a WhatsApp message one afternoon that just said, hello, we play the guitar and drums and would like to jam.
My friend David, he wants to go straight away.
That Sunday, Jose brought a carload of Timor-Leste guys out here to my studio, and we shared cups of coffee and jammed and exchanged songs, and yeah, that was the beginning of it all. And so I carried on jamming with these guys and meeting more of them each weekend.
It's just such an amazing story that Billy, you know, went and put a flyer in the Midfield Meats abattoir in the same way that people used to put a flyer in a record shop looking for a drummer, you know?
12 months on, Justin Rudge, the director of Port Fairy Folk Festival, heard that Billy had been collaborating with a bunch of meat workers from Timor-Leste, and things took off pretty quickly from there.
So I went over to his studio in a farmhouse out in the back blocks of Port Fairy, and they played me some songs, they told me their story. And the moment I heard them play, I was just amazed at how great they were. There was such a natural musicianship within these people.
Yeah, the festival director, Justin Rudge, said that he'd be happy to give them a slot on the program for the festival.
With only a few months to festival weekend, Billy and Jose got together with a professional percussionist from Dili, David Darba, who'd been working on the boning room of the abattoir. Together, they gathered a group of 13 performers.
They all either work in the boning room or on the kill floor.
This will be, for most of them, their first performance on a stage.
There was a definite language barrier. I had no experience with the Timor Leste culture at all. They were all speaking Tetuan and a little bit of Portuguese. But that's the beautiful thing about music, is it's the, you know, the universal language.
Side of stage in 1 minute.
Come festival weekend, the newly formed group, Lian Husi Timor, hit the Port Ferry stage in full cultural costume, with feather headpieces and hand-woven tyres. Their name means Voice of Timor.
I remember watching all of the news in the late 90s as a kid when Australian peacekeeping troops went to Timor. But to be honest, they've taught me so much about the culture and the history, and they're very keen to talk about it because it is a recent history. They've all lived through it, and they're aware of Australia's involvement in it. So it's something they talk about quite a lot.
Their performance carried a message of friendship, gratitude and love.
For the last song, the last dancing, I just want to invite everyone to stand up. Yeah, you guys are amazing. I love you. I think we love you guys. I love you.
They even got the folky audience up, holding hands and dancing together. And by the end of the second performance, it was clear that that small offer of friendship Billy had extended had grown into something much bigger and wide-reaching.
I think that anything we can do with the state of the world to create more integrated, more friendly societies is obviously a great thing. And, you know, I hope it's something that we can do every year from now on. I want this to be one of those events that goes from playing a smaller stage to playing in front of 5,000 people on the main stage.
What a beautiful story. That report from ABC's Emily Bisland.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Tupong. Well, Australia's capital, Canberra, will be the site of a climate protest by young climate activists from the Pacific. It's part of a series of activities aimed at drawing attention to Australia's coal and carbon industry. And later today, a documentary film will be launched to mark the start of activism in the capital. So joining us this morning is Jacinta Fa'amau from 350pacific.org. With that, I say tsalof and welcome to the show.
Hello, for morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no worries, Jacinta. I mean, look, Pacific climate activists, they have actually been arriving in Canberra, so I'm wondering what is in store for this week?
Yeah, so we are all finally here in Canberra, and we're all here to demand that the Australian government stay true to its supposed family ties with the Pacific. This means that Australia must say no to coal and gas and prioritise scaling up safe, clean and fair renewable energy for communities. And we've got a few days set where we'll do some training, preparing our worries and planning what this day could look like. And all of this will kick off on this Friday outside Parliament House.
Of course, and that comes with the protest. What is it that you are hoping the government will reply with?
Well, we'll start a better climate action package. I know that, if the budget has been released or not, but there's, basically we are taking part in the Rise Up week of actions, and this Friday is the last day to like wrap up the big week that communities across Australia have been running little actions and events outside of MP houses demanding climate action. And so we'll be doing that the same this Friday as well.
Jacinda, I also hear that there is a bit of a documentary launch too.
Yep. So this will be premiering a film tonight in Canberra. So last year, there were a few of us who travelled to Gomeroi country to witness the destruction of the coal and gas industry on Indigenous lands. And it was powerful to bring together a whole bunch of people. We had student strikers. There were a few of us, Pacific Climate Warriors based in Oz. We had some who came from the islands, First Nations people in Australia, especially those who were from Gomeroi country. And it was just to experience the destruction that's being directly caused by the mining and drilling of the fossil fuel industry. The documentary basically captures the experience of connecting climate impacts from around the world, particularly across the ocean and the Pacific, to the destruction that's being caused here in Australia.
And the film itself, correct me if I'm wrong, is it Walimba Nigiani, Stronger Together? Is that the film itself, I know you told me a little bit about it, but what's its actual key message that you're wanting people to take away from it?
Yeah, so the key message, it's about solidarity across oceans as both our peoples demand better from the Australian government, which ties to our action this Friday as well.
And I know you touched on Australia's coal industry there. Can you just share why is it so critical to fight climate change?
For many of us across the Pacific, we don't have a choice. This is something that is dependent on our survival. We don't have a lot of choices because the alternative is not a good option for us. And it's important that people here in Australia, especially with the elections coming up later this year or early next year, that the community understand the impacts of climate change, not just here in Australia, but across in the Pacific, in like our neighbouring islands.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubon, speaking to Jacinta Farmal from 350pacific.org, climate activists on the work that they are doing, including their recent doco, Walimba Nigiani, Stronger Together. Jacinta, coming back to those protests, I mean, why do you think this week? I mean, I believe it's obviously scheduled to take place ahead of the budget, yeah?
Yes. So at the end of this week, we'll be outside Parliament lawns in Canberra calling on the Australian government to stop, as mentioned earlier, no coal and gas proposals and to phase out the existing fossil fuel projects that are currently in place. But it's, stop funding fossil fuels and redirecting that money towards the just transition and renewable energy that we're all trying to, figure out what that path could look like. But I guess if our government can prioritise that, then that's something that we could deem as successful from our actions this week.
Interesting enough, I know you've highlighted how destructive, the extractive industry is to the climate and the Pacific. But the Australian government also says, they've spent millions on climate adaptation. Is that not a fair trade-off?
Definitely not a fair trade-off. I am aware that Australia has put in place some sort of climate action plan, but it's one thing to say they are doing all these good things to protect the environment, but at the same time they still one of the world's biggest exporters of coal. And, yeah, that just doesn't make sense. It's not good enough.
Well, I suppose then, as the big brother in the region, what can Australia do better then with?
I know that there is a lot on the line in the next couple of years, and there is the world is watching how Australia demonstrate their relationship with the Pacific, on all levels. But I know that Australia needs to listen to its First Nations people here in the country first before it worries about improving its relationship outside of its borders. There is still a lot of work to do just around climate justice here in Australia, and that's a perfect place to start for our Australian government.
Absolutely. And look, we wish you well for later tonight on the launch of that doco, but just appreciate your time this morning, Jacinta.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
No worries. That, of course, is Jacinta Fa'amau, climate activist from 350pacific.org. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. You will find any of our top stories on our website. You simply just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. And remember, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. Remember, I'll be back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can always hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next, and coming up after that, it is the boys Jacob and Michael on Nisha Daily. Until next time, Otoa Ofa Anto, I'm your host, Egi Tupou, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat.